Coming up this time, the medieval moat discovered near Tewkesbury, how every ancient building has a story to tell,
and how getting up high can help us discover more about what's down below.
Welcome to the Time Team Podcast.
Yes, welcome to the Time Team Podcast. I'm Martin Williams, and that is Dr. Helen Geek. And together we explore the world of archaeology to take you behind the scenes of one of what is probably the world's biggest show on the subject. First, though, Helen, before we get going, here we are, mid-December. How Christmassy are you feeling at the moment?
Well, I'm feeling pretty Christmassy because I sing in a choir and we've been practicing our Christmas stuff since September. Okay. I know, it was quite hot.
You're done. You're ready for it to be over.
But we've already had our first couple of Christmas concerts, so I'm really in the mood now.
Okay, well, the reason that I mention it is because I am getting ready for our very special Christmas episode. It's coming out on Christmas Eve, the 24th of December, obviously, and it's going to sound a little bit different to what you might be used to on this podcast. We're doing what people in my family enjoy doing a lot at Christmas time, which is a quiz. And loads of people here at Time Team have come up with questions. And Helen, you are going to be battling it out against someone else from Time Team. But who are you going to be taking on? Bring on the festive challenger.
Hi, Ellen. It's me, Derek, and I cannot wait to challenge you in the quiz. I hope you've been revising, because I have.
Oh, dear me. Derek is literally the head of the archaeology department at Bournemouth University, and that is one of the best university departments in the UK, so he is quite a daunting opponent.
Well, I think you two are going to be very, very well matched. Get ready for the Time Team Christmas quiz. It's going to be dropping into your podcast feed on Christmas Eve. On the way then in this episode, John Hart from Cotswold Archaeology is going to be telling you about what could have been a medieval moat which has been discovered near Tewkesbury. You'll meet Richard Parker, who is Time Team's historic buildings archaeologist. And of course, there's more questions to Helen from Patreon supporters, and you can submit yours right now by heading to patreon.com/timeteamofficial.
Now, following on from Martin's chat with Bear, who's responsible for creating the 3D graphics you see on Time Team, we'd like to introduce you to Harry, who operates the drone. Now, that's used to get those fantastic aerial shots, and not only do they look amazing, they're also really useful for setting a site in the context of the surrounding landscape. Martin's been finding out how it all works. Taking
off. I'm Harry Manley, and I am flying the drone and being a field archaeologist.
How are drones used in archaeology?
They can be used in two different ways, mainly for filming, for Time Teams, for the videography, but I tend to use it as a prospection tool. So we can fly above the ground surface and we can begin to detect anomalies. So use it for aerial mapping effectively in the first instance, but we can also use the images we collect, if we collect enough of them, to make or carry out photogrammetry, which then produces a 3D topographic surface, which can then be filtered, and we can then pick out the very small lumps and bumps on the ground surface.
And how important is it to get that bird's eye view? Because a lot of archaeology is being on your hands and knees, working in the ground in a very small hole. Zooming out and getting that wider view in the landscape, how important is that to an archaeologist?
It's really important because we can't dig the whole landscape, so we need to pinpoint where we're going to put the trenches. So it's used in tandem with geophysics, for example, and historic cartography. We'll actually use all different strands of evidence to then find the best or the most likely place to dig, and then that allows us to position our trenches in the correct place. So the drone has got a GPS antenna on there, so we know it's exactly where it is in the landscape, so we can marry up the data with cartography and other aerial photographs and the geophysics. And then it's really sort of a lot of computational software, which then sort of filters the data, strips out unnecessary data, and just leaves us then with those very small, subtle lumps and bumps, which we use then to infer the presence of archaeology.
Also, it just looks amazing, doesn't it? Some of the views that you get from these drones. And this has been a fairly recent thing that you've been able to get such amazing images.
Yeah, we're all used to using Google Earth, really, you know, and panning around, and that's fantastic. But we're relying on that data being provided to us. With drones, we can, if we want an image, just a bird's eye, a vertical image, we can just say, send the drone up, Harry, get Harry, send the drone up, and then we can almost get real-time data. And that's really, really powerful, and it's really revolutionised the way we're carrying out excavations or planning excavations, carrying them out, and also recording them as well, because at the end of the dig, I'll be going around using the drone to actually get images to help us understand and interpret the data as well.
Harry Manley, Time Team's archaeologist come drone operator. And you know, Martin, listening to that, I just am sent back into time and thinking about how we used to use the helicopter on old Time Teams.
Which a lot more was, expensive a helicopter, isn't it?
It was massively expensive and massively, it really disrupted everything we were doing because it was so noisy. You could only really do it over lunchtime when people didn't need to be capturing other shots with camera and sound recording. So we could hardly use it at all. You know, we certainly didn't have it on every site. And other sites that didn't have enough money for helicopters, you used photographic towers, which could get you up a certain distance. And at Sutton Hoo, we used a kite. So you needed a specialist person who could fly a kite. And then you needed a special camera with a special shutter release. And then you didn't know what you were getting until you landed the kite. And you hoped that you didn't break the camera while you were doing it. So everything was so difficult. And the drone is so easy. It's just changed things so much for the better.
It really has. And by the way, you can see drone shots in action in our latest video on YouTube. It's from the Knowe of Swandro on Roosay in the Orkney Islands. And Time Team has been excavating and finding out a bit more about the 5,000-year-old Neolithic chambered tomb, Iron Age roundhouses, Pictish buildings, Viking settlements and the Norse long haul, all on that site. And the race is on, really, to get the archaeology done before it's eroded by the sea and lost forever. If you haven't given it a watch yet, please do. It's there for free at the Time Team official YouTube channel.
One of the things we're keen to do here on the Time Team podcast is introduce you to some of the members of the Time Team family and explore what they do and how they do it.
You've heard from Stuart already. Now it's time to introduce Richard Parker. Richard is Time Team's historic buildings archaeologist. Hello, Richard.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And really excited to know a little bit more about what you do. You're described as a historic buildings archaeologist. So what is a historic buildings archaeologist?
It's a sort of mixture of art historical understanding of a building, where you look at the building and you try and read it through its plan form and its the date and style of its architectural features, and the actual sort of archaeological analysis of the fabric, where you look at the way a building has been constructed, the materials it's constructed with, and try and assess its date through that. So it's two processes, one slightly more scientific than the other. My main role in Time Team has been crawling through people's lofts. It was my great pleasure and privilege to be slid into people's lofts through very narrow hatches and crawl down the length of their ceilings looking at their roof timbers. And we came up with fabulous discoveries.
Do you think you look at a building differently to how other people look at it? I mean, the average person might walk along a street and think, well, that one's made of red bricks, or that building is extra tall, but that's about it. What do you see when you look at a building for the first time?
People with my background do see buildings differently. They look at a building and they think, oh, that's fabulous. Early 18th century thing, or that one has been hideously mauled but has good bones. Sometimes you can look at just the shape of the exterior and think, there's a fabulous roof in there. So you can read them through their skin a bit.
And what sort of things can you discover then from doing that, from peeling back the layers? What is a building able to tell you about maybe the people that lived in it or its purpose and function?
Generally, buildings tell a story of ambition and failure. So if you go into an old farmhouse, you know, and you suddenly find yourself in a stupendous 16th century hall house, You sort of see the family who built this place have risen in the world and had ambition, and that ambition somehow wasn't sustained. People live their lives in these places. Everybody who occupies a building tends to leave their personal mark on it in some way or other. This accumulation of layer upon layer upon layer of human intervention is what makes historic buildings archaeology so utterly fascinating and often very poignant.
What's your favourite period of history for looking around a building? Like, for example, what are you able to tell from a Tudor building or maybe a Victorian building? Or is there a particular era that gives you the most pleasure to find out things about?
I adore medieval and early post-medieval houses. So from the 13th century to the beginning of the 18th century, that is a period of absolute fabulousness in architecture down here. I also have an amazing soft spot for Victorians because they get such a bad press, and they were so interesting and they were so thorough, and we know more about the Victorians because they publicly agonized about everything they did. Even the greatest Victorian architects had severe doubts about whether their building might be possibly too good or possibly not good enough. And Victorians were worried about context. They liked their buildings to fit in. They wanted to make a positive contribution to the architecture of the world. So I love them because they're a little bit hapless and not universally beloved.
The underdog, maybe.
They are, honestly, you know. Most people, they go through a town, they say, oh, pity about all the Victorian stuff. They go to a church and say, oh, disastrously restored by... This was done by John Loughborough Pearson, one of the finest architects that's ever existed. This restoration is a masterly and sensitive restoration. I think we need to sort of reassess Victorians and their contribution to our towns.
Well, let's lead the charge right here. Let's start that right now. The Victorians, they've been criticised too much.
Just before I let you go, Richard, I know whenever I'm doing DIY, and certainly on a house that is sort of from 1953 or whatever, and you'll look under a floorboard and you'll maybe find an old newspaper with a date on it, or you'll find out, I don't know, a disused cigarette packet or something that would give you a little insight into a person who maybe left it there, or something that you don't expect to find. What's the strangest thing that you've ever found inside a building?
Oh, that's a hard one. You find, you know, mummified rats. Mummified rats quite often turn up. Shoes. People tend to hide shoes in buildings. But I think you do sometimes also, I mean, if you're very fortunate, I've never been found one of these myself. You get things like bottles with strange contents, probably being sort of deposited for magical reasons or something of the kind. My favourite moments ever in archaeology have been sticking my head up through an attic hatch and nearly falling back off the ladder because of the fabulousness of the roof. And you're standing on the toilet cistern in somebody's miserable little bathroom, and up above this is this kind of bitless cave of glorious timbers, all moulded and carved and painted and covered in, you know, the heads of kings and bishops. And it's remarkable what you can find in people's lofts.
If only they knew. Wow, what a story. If only they knew about the mummified rats as well, but I think the less said about that, the better.
Yes,
Richard,
quite.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Please come on again, and really looking forward to hearing what more you have to say.
Well, I'd be very happy to come on again, yes, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you, Richard. That's Richard Parker, Time Team's historic buildings archaeologist. I think Richard's absolutely right in that buildings, particularly houses, they can really speak of their past inhabitants. They give us a kind of emotional connection across the centuries to the people that lived and died there. And like us, they were trying to make a space to live in, but they're also trying to say something about themselves. Your house, like your clothes, is one of the ways that you show who you are. So I find them really fascinating. And again, like LIDAR, anyone can study a building or a streetscape. All you have to do is go outside and look around you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the ways that you can interact with archaeology without, you know, even having to have any knowledge of it at all, or indeed getting your hands dirty and getting in a trench. This is the Time Team podcast, our Christmas quiz episode on the way on the 24th of December there, Christmas Eve. Helen and Derek from Time Team are going to be going head to head. And there's another special episode coming out after that on the 7th of January that also features Derek. More on that, though, next time. Patreon questions to Helen coming up shortly. And just as a reminder, if you're thinking of a Christmas present for the person in your life who loves history, fascinated by archaeology and what we do here at Time Team, then why not consider gifting them Patreon membership? They'll get exclusive Time Team content like extended interviews, behind the scenes information, you know, the bonus videos. You will get the knowledge that you're supporting archaeology, education and community outreach here in the UK and around the world. Right now on Patreon, you can see the Christmas live panel event. We ran a whole host of Time Team archaeologists there discussing their work and answering your questions in real time. Go and check it out.
There are archaeological excavations happening up and down the country and all over the world as we speak. Here on the Time Team podcast, we want to find out more about some of the remarkable discoveries being made.
Just outside of Tewkesbury, they've discovered a medieval moat on a farm site, which has got a lot of people talking, so we definitely need a little bit more information. John Hart is from Cotswold Archaeology, who've been carrying out the excavations. Hi, John.
Hello. Good to see you.
Lovely to see you, John. And tell us a bit more about this site, because it does sound very interesting. I have a particular interest in moated sites, partly because of where I live in Suffolk. It's absolutely full of them. But what is a moated site like in Gloucestershire?
Well, it's a fantastic site, as you say. It's I should mention that it's a developer-funded site, so anyone hoping to visit it, it's been built on. So the moated site itself, it was actually visible earthwork, so you could physically see it. And a tiny scrap of it still remains, so there is a little bit left on private land. It's about 65 metres long by about 55 metres across, rectangular rather than, I guess we generally imagine moats to be circular. And it has a platform inside, which is where you'd have your buildings, your gardens, your orchard, perhaps kitchen garden, working area. And outside there are further buildings. So our team, our fieldwork team, went to site about 5 years ago now, and they very bravely endured some very medieval weather conditions to excavate this on the Severn floodplain. So it's a very damp, low-lying part of Gloucestershire rather than the Cotswold Hills that people might be more familiar with.
So I was going to ask you, actually, how does it work with the water? Because the moats where I live are all on clay, and so once the water's in, it tends to stay. Is that how the water got into your moat and how it stayed, because it was so low-lying?
Very much so. So we're on the clay vale here. It's a clay site. It's not up on the limestone uplands of the Cotswolds. It's about 80 metres from something called the Carrant Brook, which is a tributary ultimately of the River Severn, and there was a little leat which is shown on historic mapping, actually, that fed the moat. And we know from geoarchaeological analysis that the moat did hold water. There are moats that were apparently dry through their lifetime, but this one definitely held water.
So what did you think it was being used for? I mean, obviously, you know, some people say, the word moat and you think defence, but it's also water, so is that fish?
Yeah, I was going to say, what was the moat? What was it around, you know?
Absolutely. The site originates as a greenfield development. It's previously undeveloped. In around the mid-12th to 13th century, that sort of high medieval period, the sort of era, the golden age of the medieval period, you know, between the Norman conquest and before the plague. So it's when things are going well. We know from later documentary references that this site, Cowfield, as it was called, belonged to Tewkesbury Abbey. And it was run by tenants of the abbey. And we're talking about sort of wealthier peasants or perhaps lesser gentry in terms of status. And the big clue's in the name, Cowfield. We're pretty sure, taking together all the strands of evidence, that this was a vaccary, which is basically, think cattle ranch. So it's a dairy farm, essentially. Right on the edge of Tewkesbury, it would have encompassed hay fields, meadows, drier pasture and probably some woodland as well.
So the moat's being used to protect the cattle, protect the farm?
Yeah, so the moat, we found the remains of a building in the northern edge of the moat, and very little of it survived, only sort of parts of the foundations. But the best guess is that's the farmhouse, and it would have been a sort of timber structure on dwarf stone walls. The moat's probably aggrandizing that, so it's It's making it look more imposing. It would have been quite a decent house itself. And with a barn outside the moated area, we also found traces of, which would also have been a quality building, something that looked decent. But moats are they're quite complex things in the medieval mind. Yes, they're partly to do with security. It's an age before police forces. Cowfield is a few kilometres outside Tewkesbury itself. It's not in a nucleated village, so it's an isolated farmstead. You're open to burglary or casual violence or the like. When the moat was built, we're talking a period slightly later than the original farmstead. We were able to dendrochronologically date timbers from a bridge there, and it was built between the 1440s and the 1480s. That encompasses various periods of repair and renewal. But if you put that in a historical context, we're talking broadly the Wars of the Roses there. There is a need for some element of security, but it's not defensive. It's security, but it's also displaying your status. You've got a moat, therefore you're one of the, you know, you're one of the up and coming people. You're relating yourselves to the people who've also got moats, who live in grander houses and in castles and the like.
So it's like owning a Ferrari, basically. You got a Ferrari or a Porsche on the drive. If you've got a moat in your back garden, you're doing all right.
It's exactly like that, yeah.
And semi-useful in that if you have a Ferrari, you can take it to the shops. If you've got a moat, yes, it looks amazing, but you can also keep fish in it and get your Friday night supper out of it.
Exactly, and it's nearer where fish are important because you're religious and you're not eating meat every day. We did actually find a couple of weights, which we can't specifically identify as fishing weights, but one of them may have been a fishing weight. So they may well have been taking fish from their moat or at least from the nearby stream.
I must go and have a look at those in the report, because lead weights are a really difficult thing to date. And the great thing about a moat is that it's a kind of trap for finds, isn't it? If you lose anything in your moat, you are not going to find it again until archaeologists come hundreds of years later. So what kind of other finds did you get?
Well, we had a lovely range of finds, everything from the usual things that you'd expect to find as an archaeologist, so pottery and the like. And some of the pottery was absolutely fascinating. It reflects the status of the inhabitants. So I was talking about them being wealthier peasants or lesser gentry. Normally you'd expect sort of a peasant diet to be pottages, stews, that kind of thing. We know that from analysis of pottery sherds elsewhere. These people were also eating roasted meat. So we were finding dripping trays, ceramic dripping trays, which, you know, really only have one use, which is putting under your sort of Sunday joint so that they're eating well. That's not just because they enjoy eating roasted meat. It's a way of expressing status. So you're saying, this is how we dine. And that ties into polite dining habits, everything just as now, the way you dress, the way you act, reflects the image you want to put out to other people. Other things we found a very interesting, a little ceramic cup, which our pottery specialist thought might well be a laying in cup. So for a young mother still in bed, it would have been useful for her drinking things like soup, something easily digestible.
Is it called a laying in cup because there's often rituals, aren't there, around birth, because it's such a dangerous time for both mother and baby? Do we know that there were special cups that were used to keep the mother in tip-top condition, so to speak?
I think that was her best guess, rather than it being a common form, you know, it's like a tankard or a jug or a bowl, that sort of thing. If it is true, it's a lovely little insight into the life. You know, it's a reminder that they're not just farming cows, they're not just cleaning out moats or what have you. There's a family life going on in the background.
Yeah, you get a real insight into the real lives of the people who were living there. John, it's so interesting, and I'd love to know what happens next.
Yeah, so the moat's part of a development site. I believe the construction work is all finished now, so it's private land. It's not possible to visit it. But what we've done is write a report. You can access that free via our Cotswold Archaeology Reports online page of our website. The finds are all going to the local museum.
So we can all come and look at the ceramics and marvel at the variety of them. It's really exciting to hear about pottery that's not just providing a date, but providing an insight into real life.
Absolutely, yes, yes. And I should give a shout out to our pilgrim's badge as well. So the a lead pilgrim badge, which it shows St. George and the dragon. We think it probably came from Mont Saint-Michel in France. So we can't prove that the inhabitants went there or an inhabitant of the farm went there, but somebody went there and brought it back, which is, again, a nice little aspect of their medieval life. Yeah, it's quite a way to travel when it's all by foot or horse.
It's so rare to find a pilgrim badge in context, because when people lose them, they look for them and they usually find them again if they've lost them at home. If you'd lost it in a moat, of course, you wouldn't find it again.
You're not getting it back.
No, you're not.
You're not getting your book. It's gone.
Absolutely. And it must be that something like 95% of pilgrim badges have been found out of a decent context, because they are lost and not found. They're just lost as you go around your everyday life. And there's a new project actually at Reading which is looking at what things like pilgrim badges say about religious life in England. And so having this one from a known site, from you know what was going on, you know the kind of person who was wearing it and who dropped it and lost it, that's just a fantastic thing to have. So I'm going to go to the report and have a look at that pilgrim badge as well.
I think we both are. John, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. And I'll give a last shout out to our field team, because they did all the hard work. I'm just here claiming credit.
Well done, the field team. That's it. Come on, the field team.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, John.
Okay, questions time now on the Time Team podcast. And if you want to submit a question for Helen to answer about archaeology or Time Team or anything like that, you need to go on Patreon to do it, patreon.com/timeteamofficial. I've got two questions here that I suppose are pretty much the same, so I'll group them together. One's from Marcus, and we've got another one here from CCZ. So Marcus says, I have a question for Helen. What kind of work goes on behind the scenes to get all of your research into the archaeological record? We talk a lot about the archaeological record. I think I saw once that in the Channel 4 days, Time Team was responsible for most of the archaeological academic papers that were being published. Are you still writing papers? Because you're always recording trenches. Where does that information go? There must be this big database somewhere. That is what Marcus said. And CCZ, similar question. I've heard you talking about the records for all your digs being available. Where or how can we access them? And are these records issued after all the post process at the lab is done, or is it done before that, I guess? So I suppose that's the question then. How can you access this work, and what is done after a dig to record what's been found?
Yeah, great questions. I'm not completely sure that we were responsible for most academic papers. What Time Team was responsible for was a great deal of research field work. So that's archaeological excavations that aren't done in advance of building work. And at one point, we were the second biggest funder of research field work in the UK after Historic England. So when we were working with Channel 4, all of this was recorded and written up by Wessex Archaeology. We gave them our research file. They had done all the recording on site, and all the reports are on their website. And you can find every single one of them by simply Googling Wessex Archaeology Time Team, and you scroll down to find downloadable copies. Now, that was when we were a kind of massive machine motoring on with 13 episodes a year. Now things are a bit different, because each excavation is we use a bespoke partner to write up and to record. And so some of the time that's Cotswold Archaeology, some of the time somebody else will take responsibility for it, like a local archaeological group or and so on. So at Baden we were working with James Gossip and a local archaeological group, and that's carried on. So one thing as well that takes that you have to remember is it takes such a lot of time to get these out. And we used to say, I think, that within a year or two we would deposit it with the local historic environment record, which is the formal way of getting it into the archaeological record. But getting it out on a website can take a bit longer. And I think that to make it easier for the general public, we are going to need to put those somewhere on a central Time Team website, rather than having them in the different historic environment records and with all the different units, because otherwise you have to do so much of the work. So that's something that we must get organised over the next year or so.
final question comes from David Allen Jones. And this is related to a conversation that we were having about the sheer volume of pottery that's been discovered and gets discovered on archaeological sites. And David says, not quite true that broken pottery had no use. Didn't the Romans use broken pots in their waterproof concrete, Helen?
Well, yes, that is true, that ground-up pottery does have a couple of uses. And one of the things that it's used for throughout prehistory and history is as a filler or a temper in new pottery. So pure clay, pure wet clay, can be very unstable and prone to shrinking and cracking and breaking in the kiln. And if you add a filler or a temper to it, it makes it more stable. And ground-up pottery is known as grog. I don't know why.
It's known as
grog when it's used in this way. It's rather Christmassy, isn't it? Yes.
I'll have a pint of grog, please.
Yes, quite. You don't want ground-up pottery, do you? You hope you don't get that. But David is right that it's used in opus signinum, which is this very attractive red flooring material. It's a bit like modern terrazzo. And when I heard this question, I looked up what opus signinum means. I mean, I've been talking about it for years, but I've never actually known where the words come from. Apparently, it actually means work of Signia, and Signia is a Roman town in Italy that's famous for its tiles. So logically, opus signinum is the work that includes the building work that includes the tiles. It's a kind of waterproof floor. It's used in Roman baths, and it's also used in Anglo-Saxon monasteries like Monk Wearmouth and Jarrow, where it gives a kind of Roman sophistication, but without having to go to the lengths of building a mosaic, which I think was a bit beyond the Anglo-Saxons, to be frank. But Roman cement, yes, now that's a fascinating subject. And for this, we have a bit of historical data as well as archaeological, because Vitruvius, the Roman author who writes about building and architecture at around the time of the Emperor Augustus, so that's something like 25 BC, he gives us a recipe. And for modern lime cements, you would be mixing sand and lime to a paste with water. But for Vitruvius, for Roman cement, which is much more durable, he says to use volcanic sand. Now, you would think, well, that's fine for the Romans. They have places like Naples and Sicily, which are full of volcanoes. But actually, this stuff, this waterproof cement, is found all over the empire. And it seems that they were shipping it abroad from place to place to use in high-quality imperial projects. You can find it literally all over the Roman Empire. It's quite extraordinary. And it is waterproof, which is amazing. And it's recently been found, there's been some very recent research that has discovered that if you mix the lime as quicklime, which is quite dangerous stuff, rather than slaked lime, you get a different kind of chemical composition, which makes the cement self-repairing. So that if it cracks underwater, I know it's quite extraordinary. It kind of absorbs the water and reseals itself. It is quite extraordinary. But I see that I've got myself completely sidetracked away from pottery, which I do tend to do. So essentially, cement floors can include ground-up pottery, but this can only ever have used a really tiny percentage of all that massive amount of pottery that got broken day in, day out. And it's only really recycled in a large scale in the Roman period. Prehistoric and medieval pottery had almost no use once it's been broken. It can't be recycled in the way that we think of recycling.
Yeah, I mean, recycling is an interesting one, isn't it? So they sort of did do recycling in Roman times, which you don't really think of, because I'm just thinking of all the sheer number of bins that I have and have to deal with, and I never thought the Romans would have to bother with that stuff. But did they recycle in a way, you know, they like reuse items and things like that?
Well, recycling, yes. Anything that could be melted down would be melted down and reused. So that's all metals, and it's also glass. But things that you can't melt down, like pottery or wood or bone or antler, or thinking of a slightly higher class material, ivory or horn, well, things like wood, you know, that's a very cheap material. I mean, literally grows on trees. As long as you could afford new materials, you'd use them. So ivory probably is carved into smaller and smaller and smaller things. But I think these days, recycling tends to be a performative art that's kind of laden with status. Look at me, I'm so good, I recycle. That you get brownie points for bringing things in an old cardboard box rather than a new plastic bag. Whereas in the ancient world, there was no status associated with recycling. It was what you did when you were poor. So if you could get something that was new and flashy, you would use something that was new and flashy, and it would only be people who couldn't afford anything else who would use reused and recycled things.
Yeah, I don't think it's been that long that we've been that people have been sort of seen as socially wonderful for bringing a cardboard box rather than a plastic bag. But if you've got something new and it's shiny, people probably think that you're doing all right for yourself. Well, thank you for the answers to those questions. Thank you for the questions themselves, by the way. If you want to send one in, it's really, really easy. You just got to be a Patreon supporter. So head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for all the details.
So that's it for this episode. Why not join us next time on Christmas Eve for our festive special, where I'll be going head to head with Derek in the Time Team Christmas Quiz. Speak to you then. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.